Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. Just before we start our next episode, we're going to reflect on the last episode, Mission is Nothing, Intent is Everything. And we've had a request to perhaps review some corporate mission statements and look at the construct and maybe even pass comment. So I'm going to get Ben to comment on them. I've just selected three. The first one is Uber, and their mission statement is, we ignite opportunity by setting the world in motion.
I reckon if you go back to our discussion on task and purpose, it contains both of those things. You know, in a military parlance, you would probably say we set the world in motion in order to ignite opportunity, but it's all there. And I think this is a good example of a vision that can inspire a company and provide a lot of latitude for nesting actual tangible tasks in. So the trick, obviously, with any organisation is to translate that vision into reality and to translate it into the day-to-day tasks. So the strategy of the company would need to be nested within that. But that does provide the good aspirational vision that can energise, can drive people within the company to work towards. So I actually reckon it probably works out pretty well.
On to Tesla, multi-billion dollar company. Their mission statement is to accelerate the world's transition to sustainable energy.
Again, that's a good vision. However, this is a good example of one where, you know, we want to make sure there's a golden thread of logic between the vision and the actions down at all levels. And in this particular case, certainly the idea of battery power and sustainable renewable energy sources is a good one. But if in the process of producing these batteries, we're creating more carbon than we're replacing by displacing fossil fuels, then we might hit a sort of small disconnect that if we really wanted to have a negative carbon impact, maybe we'd look at different ways. But I think, again, at that big picture level, it's very clear what they're trying to do. And I think, you know, cascaded down properly through the organisation, it could serve as a really good vision to work towards.
Vision or mission?
I'd say that's more a vision. Yeah, and I think, you know, the strategy, and this is where these terms get used very interchangeably, but the part of that strategic process with any organisation is to make it clear, well, what are our tasks? What's our no-kidding day-to-day activities that we need to do? And then what's that shiny city on the hill that we're working towards?
Mm. And you could build a mission statement outside of that Tesla vision, if indeed they elevated it to a vision statement, where that component was the purpose.
So exactly.
The task insert, and the purpose being that vision statement to accelerate the world's transition to sustainable energy. On to Coca-Cola. To refresh the world in mind, body and spirit, to inspire moments of optimism and happiness through our brands and actions.
Wonderful. I'd like to buy the world a Coke on the back of that. But again, this is where the devil's in the detail in terms of how it's cascaded down. Obviously, all these companies we've spoken about have a profit-making purpose. So it's good to have these aspirational visions and very, noble end states that they're working towards. But at some point, they need to pay the bills. At some point, they need to please the shareholders and stakeholders. And so as those things cascade down through the organisation, there needs to be a transparency of intent. So there needs to be, we can't pretend that the only thing we're trying to do is refresh the world in mind, body and spirit, because obviously there's a disconnect somewhere if we're not categorically stating that we also want to make a profit along the way.
So mission is task and purpose, and we're going to talk a lot about social purpose today, and it's been very topical over the last 12 months. In fact, there's a nice Forbes article out about 9 predictions for social purpose in 2019 is the title. And our next guest, Elizabeth Armstrong, knows all about social purpose. Let's get on with the show.
So today we are extremely lucky to be joined by Elizabeth Armstrong, who's currently the director of the Pongsi facility operating out of Yangon in Myanmar. Now, Elizabeth has got a fascinating background. She is well and truly a proven strategic advisor. She's an incredible leader and a manager, and she's got over 20 years of experience in a whole range of political, economic, and transitional contexts, the majority of which have been in very challenging environments. She moved to Myanmar in April 2014 to establish the Pongsi facility, which was formerly known as the Peace Support Fund. And it was initially designed to provide rapid and flexible support to the peace process and also to intercommunal harmony efforts. But now it's focused exclusively on supporting social cohesion throughout Myanmar, which is a fascinating and incredibly worthy purpose. Prior to that, Elizabeth's also been a member of the Australian Foreign Service. She's been the Director of Economic Reform in Australia's National Reform Council, and she's worked as a Senior Advisor on International Affairs in the Australian Prime Minister's Department, again, focusing on those really wicked problems in places like Asia, the Middle East, Europe and North Africa. She's got a Master's degree in Economics and in Peace and Conflict Studies, and she's currently pursuing a PhD on the role of the private sector in reconciliation and peace building. So with a resume like that, I reckon we'll have no shortage of things to talk about, and we're really looking forward to our chat. Elizabeth, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. How are both of you?
Also well, thank you so much for joining us. Now, we've given a bit of a potted history there, but it'd be a great way to start by if you could just provide a bit of a background to how you got to where you are today in Myanmar.
Well, it was not a straight line, and I've come to view straight lines in CVs with some trepidation when I'm hiring people. I think there's great value in taking a path that is not so standard. I was rather impressed with a young millennial in my team who's remarkable, who was explaining to me the process that he went through to decide on his current career path. And he researched what he wanted to do and what he wanted to be, and he interviewed people and he set out a budget and he strategically chose, you know, this region and this country. And I can honestly tell you that I did not do any of that.
Well, this is about living a life less ordinary. We don't like linearity nor constant vectors. And in fact, most of our guests have not had any of that.
And I think there's great fun and joy in following the signposts to some degree, and to knowing what your strengths are and going by instinct sometimes. And that's really what I did certainly at the beginning. And I've a family who encourages that as well. And I think that's an important part of being someone who's been willing to take some risks and take some different, let's call them non-standard decisions. I mean, I knew right from the start that I wanted to follow my strengths. I knew I wanted to work internationally. I knew that I'm most energized when I'm making a difference in people's lives. And I realized long ago that I would, while I'm a great planner and executor, I'm not the one to run the spreadsheets. And so with that in mind, I embarked on a career initially actually in environmental management, which was as pressing an issue 20 years ago as it is now, and started out down that path of learning about structural reform and environmental management, particularly related to Australia's water resources, but more broadly. And in my first master's thesis, I focused on behavioural change and how you ask people to shift behaviour that is damaging, this case related to environmental management. And, you know, the simple answer was really it has to hurt. They need to see the damage that they're creating. And I didn't know then, of course, how useful that thesis would be to me now in Myanmar in terms of natural resource management. But from there, that led me to my first international posting in the South Pacific, which was a regional posting, which was a remarkable couple of years. And then I returned to Australia working for Foreign Affairs and Trade in a more mainstream international affairs role, and also had the privilege of working with Prime Minister and Cabinet for the first time in Canberra. And I mean, these issues that we dealt with were, you know, everything from the U.S. Free Trade Agreement to the Thai Free Trade Agreement to various economic issues that we were challenged with at the time. But I had itchy feet, and off I went to North India. And looking back on that time, it was really a turning point, because it was the first time that I'd really dealt with conflict. I was living in a state in North India which was a fusion of princely states, which had sort of been thrown together on a map, and there were deep fissures and conflicts that were still evident. And I spent a little over 2.5 years living in northern India, got an interest in yoga as a result, but met some remarkable people. And I think one of the things that was striking at the time was that everybody had a job in India, but they also had an issue. They had something that they were helping to make better. And I think in some regards, you know, in Australia, things are really good, and often we just get on with our lives and enjoy them rather than thinking, well, what sort of contribution can I make back to my country? In any case, returned to Australia thereafter and really was working predominantly on intractable conflicts through the Prime Minister's Department again, working on the Middle East. We were active in Iraq and Afghanistan. And look, that role was energising and demanding and required, you know, all my creative and strategic and collaborative skill to bring whole of government solutions to what are really tricky, you know, problems. And some of those solutions were imperfect. I mean, you both have experienced those times where you have an ideal that you would like to deliver, but the budgets aren't endless and the priorities are constantly competing. So it was a fascinating role and really sort of solidified my interest in conflict. And then in my early 30s, I got really sick. I had a period of illness and a protracted period of recovery. And as a result of that, my career sort of came shuddering to a halt. And wow. and you know, it's a long way to fall from a job that you love and you're energized by to not being able to get out of bed for a while. And in any case, I remember seeing you know, somebody that I was talking, having a conversation with, a good friend, who said to me, look, you know, you've done enough, just relax, you know, you've already made a, you know, substantial contribution, that's it. And I remember that conversation thinking, you know what, that's not it. This is not the end of my contribution. This is just the beginning, you know. And gradually rebuilding my energy and my focus, but also it was this wonderful time for reflection. And after that period of rest and reflection, I decided to go overseas with a new husband in tow and do a master's in peace and conflict studies at the University of St Andrews. And really, for the first time, I felt like all those skills and random lessons that I had learnt and built were starting to come together for me. So I did a year in St Andrews doing a master's degree, and then I embarked on a PhD program. And then, of course, left field, as my mother would describe it, entered mm-hmm. into my life. And I was offered a job here in Myanmar. Myanmar was one of the case studies in my PhD at the time. And I was offered a role that I really couldn't refuse. You know, they came to me and said, could you set up a peace support fund in Myanmar? Now, at the time, Myanmar was of largely academic interest from a conflict point of view. It was not the front page news that it is today, but it was the beginning of the peace process. In many ways, it was this fusion of skills and interests that I had been looking for, and that was 5 years ago. So,
yeah, wow. The rest is history.
In fact, we can hear the bird song in the background. And I know it's a bit of a melting pot over there, but could you describe the streetscape of formerly Burma, now Myanmar?
Yeah, well, the streetscape in the cities has changed a great deal in the last 5 years. I mean, when I arrived in Yangon, I arrived with a mobile phone and had to buy a SIM card that cost me $1,000 and I had to borrow somebody's identity to do it. I had to bring in a bag of $10,000 in cash for me to do it. All of this is, you know, I'm able to say now, but wasn't at the time. And now a SIM card is free with a phone, and there are ATMs everywhere. And I think that's a really good indication of what's happened in the last 5 years. And the cities are expanding, of course, as people come to the cities for opportunities. But not so much has happened and changed in the countryside, and you've still got vast populations that are affected by conflict, even those populations that have signed up to what is referred to as the Nationwide Ceasefire Agreement. George Orwell wrote of Burma in his essay Shooting the Elephant that a story always sounds clear enough at a distance, but the nearer that you get to the scene of events, the vaguer it becomes. And never was this more true than in Burma. You know, it really does. The closer you look, the more you realise that you don't even see, let alone understand. Mm. And, you know, you have a country that has had 300 years of conflict. This is not decades of conflict. This is hundreds of years of conflict. 135 languages, 22 armed groups, and deep societal exclusion and mistrust that is embedded and normalized and structurally solidified into legislation and practice and daily practice by individuals and by organizations. So it's a very challenging environment to begin to shift.
Without a doubt. I visited Myanmar for the first time last year and obviously met you there, and one of my first impressions was the fact that they drive right-hand drive cars on the right-hand side of the road. And I reckon that kind of sums up a little of what you're talking about, this massive sort of collision of cultures, which was actually almost a collision of car and Ben Pronk as I stepped out the wrong way. But it seemed very much that melting pot.
And we've talked previously, Elizabeth, about complexity. Is that the definition of complexity?
I think so. I'm yet to find a scenario that is as complex as the one that we find here. Indeed, Myanmar interlocutors used to say this to me when I first arrived, and they said, "Oh, it's really complex, and it's, you know, it's really difficult. It's more complex than other places." And honestly, for the first 2 years, I sort of said, "Yeah, no, it's fine." They're right. It is complex, and it's not just within Myanmar. I mean, you're sitting in a geostrategic position between, you know, two emergent world powers, and you've got very valuable natural resources off the coast and within the country. So they are in a very unique geostrategic position globally.
And just looking at that complexity, when you read your resume, a common theme emerges. You seem to be attracted to these wicked, almost insoluble problems around the place. I like that intractable conflicts that you sort of worked in. Do you ever get a sense of futility or hopelessness about what's happening? How do you sort of keep driving towards that collective good when you must see so much, selfishness and even in some cases outright evil?
Absolutely. I think that there's a couple of things that keep me going, and I think one is that you need to put your hubris to one side and remember the journey of Western culture over the last several hundred years and the evolution of, you know, human rights norms and the, you know, the rights for women, for instance, which are really very, very recent, and remember that takes time to evolve into that kind of space. And I think also I take a great deal of, I hold in a great deal of esteem and respect some national colleagues who just keep going. You know, something will shift in the environment, in the context. There'll be a decision made that apparently takes us back, and they just keep going. And I think that there's, you know, if they can keep going, I can keep going, yeah? But I do think that there's this, you know, there's a Western tendency to say, right, we've got to get it fixed in a decade. And what you're unpacking is just decades and hundreds of years of normalized practice. I mean, we have to remember that all of these people, firstly, all of them are conflict affected in some way, even those that are the elite. and they are doing their best from their worldview, from their state of consciousness. What they see that they are doing is right. And so unpacking that, unpacking what is right and wrong and how to have the most benefit over the long term in terms of, you know, all the population, that's not something we're going to fix in 10 years. I mean, we haven't achieved it in Australia relation to our Aboriginal community, and the US is still dealing with, you know, with racism. This takes a long time.
Can we turn our attention to the PSF?
Sure.
Of which you're the director. Can you talk a little bit about the organisation, its aims and the programs?
Sure, for sure. I came out in 2014 to establish the PSF, and the objective of the organisation was twofold. It was to support what was a nascent peace process at that point, and particularly to support the engagement of ethnic and armed organisations and civil society in that process, because best practice globally tells us that that's important, that it's a level playing field, and that gives you most chance of sustainable peace. And the other avenue that we supported was referred to then as intercommunal harmony. And over the preceding years, we developed a series of projects across the country that supported both of those agendas. A couple of years after we established the PSF, we also established the Joint Peace Fund, which was a much larger bucket of money that was intended to focus on the peace process, and that fund has continued and is growing and very much focused on making sure that the peace process is as inclusive as it possibly can be. We have taken in the PSF the other stream of funding, which we referred to then as intercommunal harmony, and we now refer to as social cohesion. And really our focus is getting at those deep structural fissures and those deeply held beliefs within communities across the country that some are more equal than others.
And how do you actually tangibly go about that? So we've just spoken about these intergenerational views that are so deeply seated. There's got to be a massive component of education. What tools do you use to try and, reverse these generations-old beliefs?
Yeah, look, I think there's a range of tools at our disposal, and not least dialogue as being a really important tool. And we know globally that if you can get people talking to each other, that they start to uncover some similarities, and they start to uncover some shared goals. And that doesn't happen quickly, and it needs to be accompanied with skills and processes to sit alongside it. But we have a dialogue component to the work that we fund. We also have a training component a series of different projects focus on, firstly, allowing people to reflect on their own beliefs and their own worldviews, and then teaching them how to be more constructive contributors to their communities. And we're working in Rakhine, we're working in Kachin and Shan and other parts of the country, and we do this through different mechanisms. In some parts of the country, we use sport to bring people together and to train them. In other parts of the country, we use music. In other places, we have established, you know, educational programs that are being used by schools, and including Buddhist schools, around what it is to appreciate and allow a diversity of religion. So we're very much demand-driven and localised in our approach. So if we think that a particular modality will work in a particular location, then we will pursue that. What we are not about is a cookie-cutter approach, or the IKEA flat-packed piece approach, which is it must be this way, it must be structural, it must be linear. But we do, across all of our programs, try to make the link between what's happening at the community level and the everyday peace that can be built amongst individuals and groups and families, with the structural and the more policy level change that can be affected. One of our terrific programs has gone right through from changing an approach to education around different religions right through to affecting the education policy that's drafted at the moment. So we're pretty pleased with when we can connect the top with the bottom, if you like.
One of the programs that I really liked, and I hope I get this right, was encouraging women into small business. And I think, in fact, you might talk a little bit about this, Elizabeth. There was a project that enabled women to develop new skills so that they then could take those skills out into the marketplace and of course, sell through their own business. But more importantly, it brought cultures together.
Yeah, this is a really nice project that's operated by the Centre for Diversity and National Harmony, and it brings women together around a vocational training focus, which is a very pragmatic focus and one that I tend to be an advocate for rather than policy dialogue for the sake of dialogue and training around mutually shared interests, and vocational training certainly is one of those. And this particular one brought together Muslim and Rakhine women and continues to do so, and trains them in livelihoods, small-scale livelihood jam making and soap making that will make a difference and connect them to each other but also them to a market. And it's one that I particularly enjoy because it's an illustration of how very pragmatic peace building can be. Mm-hmm. And you can step out of the esoteric, you know, closed door elite driven processes and realize that actually at the end of the day it is communities and families and individuals that are the epicenters of peace. And this is a wonderful project that is an example of that. And I think linking it to something that means something to those women every day means that there is a natural incentive for them to be involved. If you abstract peace building too far from somebody's everyday life, you make it impossible for them to participate. I mean, all of us at the end of the day need to have a livelihood, need to provide our families. Our ambitions for our children are very similar. We want them to be educated, have a better life, etc. And you have to plug into those everyday incentives in order to affect a change at the national level, but also at the subnational level. So it's a really nice program.
Spot on. As Tim mentioned before, we've spoken about this concept of complexity as a science previously, and complex adaptive system science tells us about the only thing you can manipulate is the incentives operating within a system. And so when you get that really tangible alignment between those beautiful esoteric aims and the day-to-day incentives, you can really be on a winner there.
Yeah, that's right. It's not just about making a bar of soap, is it? You know, that is a vehicle for so much more.
Absolutely. And I think being grounded, again, you come back to being grounded in the humanity of conflict, yeah, or of peace. And if you can get back to that individual level of how you would respond to incentives and tap into what communities really need, and then build peace building into that, then you're looking at sustainable peace. It doesn't make it faster, but it does make it more sustainable.
And of course, there's all sorts of other spoilers in there, isn't there? Traditionally, that part of the world has had a large drug production population, which still remains to this day.
Look, Myanmar is, you know, the second largest methamphetamine producer in the world. It's increasing every day. The Myanmar market supplies Australia. It supplies across the region. And we know that there are active drug production processes and practices across, you know, large parts of northern Myanmar. So in terms of wicked problems and incentives, you know, that's an enormous incentive for people to avoid, you know, more traditional mechanisms or more traditional and illicit trade. And that is something that I think those in Myanmar are becoming more aware of and starting to understand the incentives that are created by that industry in and of itself. But certainly the illicit economy in Myanmar it far outstrips the licit economy at present. That needs to be inverted if we're going to make a real difference to people's lives.
How do you lead inside that complex environment, Elizabeth? What are your top tips? Do you have principles that you apply? What's the secret?
Well, the secret, I'm not sure whether I have the secret, but I do try to ensure that I know as much about the context as I possibly can. As an outsider, there are some aspects of the context which you will never fully understand. So I surround myself with great people who can help me understand it better. And I think, you know, hiring a great team was one of the starting points for the success of the PSF, but it was essential to me. You know, there needs to be trust in that team. There needs to be diversity in that team. So getting the right people and trusting your people to really advise you when you know that you don't know, then you really have to reach out and say, look, I don't understand this. Can you help me? And rather than, you know, letting your ego get in front of you or making an educated guess, asking for help from your team is important. I think the other part is just treating those people with a great deal of respect and making sure that you are creating an environment, a workplace that not just you want to come to, but that they want to come to every day. And part of that is connecting what you do on a day-to-day basis, which can be quite boring some days in terms of, you know, projects and running projects and so forth, to a greater vision. And I think that is something that we've managed to do collectively as a team in the PSF, is really stay true to what our objectives are so that our hearts and our minds are in the right place at all times.
Elizabeth, I teach leadership within an MBA program, and I'm a massive fan of this concept of authentic leadership, which has its, at its kernel, the ideas of knowing yourself, humility, self-awareness, as I said, and empathy, you know, emotional intelligence. And what you've just described is exactly that. It's really impressive.
And we've also been talking about purpose, and it sounds like you've been very succinct in amplifying the purpose in the organisation, which, you know, can serve as an inspiration and a beacon to the staff.
I think that's key. You know, you want to be reminding your staff not just why they get out of bed in the morning, but what difference they're making, their individual contributions are making to the broader, bigger picture. And I think part of being a leader is to make sure that you're working effectively for your staff, that you are giving them everything they need to do their job, and part of that is giving them something to connect their energy to. And then when they fall over, because they do, people fall over, people get sick, etc., is treating those events in people's life with a great deal of compassion, so that you can get them back onto the right track and you can get them well and back into the team. I think there's again, we come back to this theme of humanity where, you know, you're dealing with people and they go through struggles in their own lives throughout the course of their day. So knowing your people and supporting them when they're having a tough time and really rewarding them and amplifying their successes across the team and across donors and across the broader community is an important part of them loving working for the organisation.
Elizabeth, is it different as a leader for a woman? Tim and I both come from a very male-dominated environment in the Army and particularly the areas we served in. I'd be interested in your reflections on the impact that different genders have and any differences in terms of style as a female leader, not only in Myanmar but in general.
It's an interesting question, and I sort of am in my early 40s, I'm at an interesting juncture in terms of the broader gender debate. I mean, in my early career, I was often the only professional woman in the room, and I needed to learn fast how to share my voice and my position and have it heard. And often there were men who sought to dismiss it. You know, I remember one unique individual who referred to me, to my face, as the token woman on the team. But those days are dissipating, and I think increasingly that there is a recognition that women bring great value to organisations, as much as men do. And I seek personally an organisation that has a balance across the genders that we can respect and learn from each other. I mean, we're certainly not there in terms of gender equality. I think that, yeah. that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that we've got a long way to go on that front. But I do see great change, and I do see great change in the generations that follow us. There is a greater acceptance that you're not a man or a woman, you're a professional. And there's less distinction now around gender in those younger cadres. I mean, I do think that there remains a wicked problem in terms of child rearing and the private sphere for women. I don't see men stepping up in that sphere as much as women are stepping up in the professional sphere. And I think that there's a rebalancing, not just at the professional level, but on the personal front as well. I mean, it's well known that women sort of carry three burdens, if you will, their professional career. Usually they're still the leader in the household, if you're the manager in the household, irrespective of their professional status. And of course, there's that kinship building, which tends to fall to women as well. So it's an interesting sort of triple burden, which we covered in a report actually that we issued in relation to Myanmar for the PSF. But it's equally true of other societies still.
Elizabeth, how do you balance life as a professional inside that complex environment that is Myanmar, alongside being a mum and a wife?
It's a challenge, and you know, I would not recommend that people plan to be setting up a fund in a transitional environment, doing a PhD and having a child at the same time. This is not.
But your CV reads to that. It absolutely reads to that. It's clearly what you revel in.
Yeah, and I think, you know, basically, if you do find yourself in that position, you need to try and enjoy it for what it is. And often I reflect on Kavafri's poem Ithaca around the journey being important, and to make sure that you take your time through that journey and enjoy it. My tips are really quite simple. Firstly, ask for help. You know, get people around you who can assist you if you're challenged in terms of time and capability. And it might just be that your mum drops over a lasagna one night a week, you know, so that it takes the pressure off on a Wednesday night or similar. But really outsourcing and delegating as much as you can is important. For me in this context, you know, there's this constant sort of struggle to keep on top of the changing context, which is very turbulent. While the fundamentals don't change rapidly, that the context is turbulent. So I really do set time aside and prioritize time to read and make sure that I'm on top of what is a very complex space. And that means deciding what your priorities are and not filling your day with other people's priorities. You know, you need to decide, where is the maximum impact of my time? And it's not always spent in meetings. Often it's thinking time or planning time or reading time. And then you need to either let the rest go or delegate it within the team. I exercise first thing out of the gate in the morning. If I don't do it, then it doesn't get done. And if I don't exercise, then I fall apart. And I think acknowledging as a leader and as a mother and as a wife that your health and well-being is pivotal to the system working around you is really important. And finally, I would recommend any working mother to read Marie Kondo's advice about household cleaning and do it. I know it's a bit of a thing at the moment, but it really does have all sorts of implications. So less is more.
That's not helping my situation. I'm a serial hoarder. I'm very sentimental about things, and my wife is really trying to declutter my life. But
Everyone's got that drawer. You put things in that drawer.
Just get rid of the drawer.
I'll probably need it for later. I might use that. Actually, one of our colleagues, just reflecting on a couple of your comments there, one of our colleagues has got a really nice way of thinking about health, and he says quite simply, if you don't have your health, you've got nothing. Happiness. How do you define happiness?
Whoa, joy. We've had a lot of sort of retrospective thought in the household recently on the concept of joy. And I think for me, happiness is a full and interesting life. It's a space where you've got the fundamentals kind of locked away. You know, you've got financial security, or you're approaching it. Your relationships are healthy, and you're able to make a contribution. I think that there's a wonderful kind of nexus there where you find what you're good at, and you find your niche, and you're able to make a contribution, either in small ways in your community and family, or in larger ways across countries or indeed more globally. So for me, it's that combination of happiness and contentment on the home front, happy, healthy children, and an ability to make a professional contribution that is not necessarily recognised. That's, for me, recognition is less of a draw, and more that you know at the end of the day that you made a difference that day, and that you made a pragmatic difference in people's lives.
And it sounds, a lot of research talks about these intrinsic motivators as being the most satisfying. And our conversation just now, I mean, you seem extremely driven. It's very clear how passionate you are about making a difference. And it sounds like what you've just said in terms of that's translation to happiness, that, you know, it doesn't need that extrinsic reward for recognition or financial gain, but it's that knowing you've made a difference.
For me, that's certainly what has always driven me. And, you know, there are moments where I thought that perhaps I should have taken the path of investment banker. But at the end of my day, it really spurs me on, and gives me a great deal of energy to know that you're making a difference in somebody else's life, even if that's, you know, in a small way, and that you've made, you've created a job for somebody, or you've been kind to someone, and so that's important. I think as a mum, for me, I mean, I derive so much joy from young Benjamin. He's a remarkable little boy, and I'm extremely grateful to be his mum. And I think with that, great responsibility, of course, but for me, life really began in some ways when I became a mum, and so I would encourage people to embark on that journey sooner rather than later as well.
Look, we spoke before, you mentioned George Orwell and his connection to Myanmar, and certainly Rudyard Kipling has a very storied, albeit short, connection into what was known as Burma. Now, we draw our name from a Kipling poem, and we like to reflect on lines from that poem. I'd just like to read you one particular line and get your perspective on that. It's from the poem If, and the line is, "If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim." What does that mean to you, Elizabeth?
Interesting that you draw on the poem If, because it was something that my mother introduced me to many, many years ago, and you know, we could have a long conversation about the gendered nature of the poem, but I think it applies equally to, you know, fully evolved individuals, not just becoming a man.
Yep.
And for me, these are core concepts in terms of how I've tried to live my life. I mean, dreaming is important. It spurs you on to greater challenges, and you can't lose sight of, within those dreams, you can't really lose sight of the life, the realness of the moment, and grasp that as tightly as you do the dreams. And I think that's the challenge, is to dream and to create things bigger than yourself and potentially push you out of your comfort zone. But equally, in every moment in the creation of that dream or a version of that dream, to be present. And in that way, you master the present, not just the dream that you're working towards. And in terms of, you know, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, in any industry, we need the thinkers. And indeed, my own background will show you that I dip in and out of academia and practice, and there's this constant sort of battle in my own mind around thinking and doing. But it's interesting, when I hire people, I'm always looking for people who can not only think, but who can turn that thinking into very pragmatic action. And there's a lot of talk, particularly in the peace building industry, but getting to that pragmatism, turning a really great concept into a pragmatic on the ground program that takes a step forward for the people that you're working with, that's enormously valuable to me. And I think most people fall into one or both categories, but those that can think and continue to think while they implement something very pragmatic is really what I look for. And it's a rare skill, but they are out there, and I think they make all the difference.
Do you know the really funny thing is how many guests that we're talking to for which the poem If has quite a profound significance?
Oh, for sure. It was interesting when, you know, I look back on my mum and I'm thinking, God, you're actually quite the feminist of your time. You know, she, no Barbies and, you know, reading this poem and various other things that she did. Not that she'd describe herself that way, but this was a really important poem, and it's actually one that I reflect on regularly, you know, in my day-to-day activities, particularly the line around, you know, not losing your head when those around you are.
Yes.
That is predominantly the line that I come back to, but in this context at least. But no, it's a really important poem, and I think, you know, you start scratching the surface, and a lot of people rely on this and, you know, a collection of others as well.
It's a great way to live your life. I gave it to my son. I think it's under the PlayStation at the moment, the poem.
I certainly know Tim's definitely a dreamer. I call him that every day. But and he does a bit of thinking as well. Listen, Elizabeth,
I'm the creative department, the outfit.
You're the ideas guy.
Which is scary.
The designer.
Elizabeth.
The architect.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute inspiration to chat to you. What you're doing is amazing, and thank you for sharing some of that with us today.
It's been special. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks, both.
Bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers. All you businessmen, politicians, get around and meet my friends.